once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English debt.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure, where we know how to say our names together.
Right. Took us a lot of practice. We've been working on it very hard.
Yeah, for what, 17, 13, 15? How many years have we been doing this?
18 years.
And what do you get?
18 years of radio.
Oh, okay.
That's all you get out of it. You've been doing it for 19 years.
You work 18 years, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt.
Yeah, this is why you're an investment advisor and not a singer.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I just sang, so that makes me a singer.
It's true. And it was successful in that you got some radio play.
Yes, so, I did.
Not many people get to sing on the radio.
Just like your sisters once sang in Carnegie Hall.
Right, in Dunfermline, Scotland. Same Carnegie, though.
Yeah, and it was Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
I mean, there was nobody else in there.
It was the first Carnegie Hall.
Right, and there was no one else in there when they were singing, but that's okay. They were singing in Carnegie Hall. Huh. They can say that they sang in Carnegie Hall.
And they did.
Well, you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach. That is the name of the radio presentation. Da-da-da. And we're supposed to do a disclaimer, disclosure, and disregarder. Doesn't that sound right? We should disregard all. Everything that follows is purely our opinion and may or may not reflect reality. That's the disclaimer. The disclosure.
I think everybody
is.
Should say that before they open their mouth, though. I really do think everyone should just walk up and say, anything I say, it's probably wrong. It might not be, but
they
try not to make it wrong.
By definition, they just said something that is probably wrong, so it's probably wrong that they're probably wrong,
right.
Which means they're probably right.
This statement is a lie.
Got it.
Wait a minute. That's how you make Pinocchio's head explode, by
right.
the way.
You
tell him my nose to say the words, my nose will grow.
Oh, now you're getting entirely too deep.
Oh.
But we're supposed to give a disclosure at this point. At least I think we're supposed to give a disclosure at this point. That this is a radio program, but it is also the name of an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. Now, we don't sell anything except our own advice, but, you know, we could have an ulterior motive here of trying to convince you that our advice is really, really good, so you would come and pay us to manage your investment portfolios or something. And the investment advisory firm in Salado is registered with and theoretically, at least,
regulated by
the United States Securities and Exchange Commission.
Which does not imply that they have any kind of approval of what we say. They just regulate
disapproval.
Us. It's just like the FBI probably does not have any direct approval over whether or not you go to work in the morning, but they may regulate it.
But you don't have to register with the FBI to go to work in the morning. But you do have to register with the SEC to be what's, quote, and I quote, a large investment advisory firm, and as opposed to a small investment advisory firm.
I don't feel any larger than some of the small people. I think that some of them are even taller than I am, and yet they're considered small investment advisors.
I don't get the rationale. By the way, they're thinking about rejiggering all that. They're always thinking about rejiggering all that.
Sometimes they even do.
Well, but the point is that, generally speaking, unless Congress, and it's pretty rare that the SEC can make a decision about anything. And the reason they can't make a decision about much of anything is the way the law is set up. The Democrats nominate half the commissioners, not nominate. The Democrats appoint half the commissioners.
Right.
And the Republicans appoint half the commissioners. Whoever is in office as president gets to choose the chairperson who has to be confirmed by the Senate. The end result is
I don't see any problem with that at all.
You have to have a bit of a supermajority. You have to have 60% of the commissioners. You have to have the commissioners from one party plus one from the other party to vote on anything to get it done. And now you know why the SEC doesn't get much done.
Well, they get really bad things taken care of a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. But that's
because
those
are things that both Republicans and Democrats can agree. Hey, that guy's stealing money. Stop that. It's a thing. We should support more businesses that are green fuel related, or the Republicans say, no, petroleum, and then nothing gets done there. And the SEC goes, where are all our jobs not really supposed to be supporting people anyway?
In 2006, the Congress passed a law that told the Department of Labor to set up a fiduciary requirement for people who handle IRAs and
that's individual retirement accounts.
And retirement accounts in general that are tax deductible when you put money into them.
So fiduciary meaning that they must operate under the same standard that a trustee at a retirement fund does, which is to operate not just in the best interest of the client, but solely in the interest of the client.
And also
recognizing that they get paid in the process.
Now, this was a Republican-controlled Senate and House that did this.
Right. In 2006.
In 2006.
In fact, it was called the Pension Protection Act of 2006.
Right. And the president was a Republican, so it was passed by. And since then, the Republicans have been blocking the Department of Labor in any form or fashion they could do so.
From actually putting the rules together to follow that law. So it's been 10 years.
But this year, it's almost certainly going to happen. But better yet.
You said that last year, though, too.
The what was the law that was passed? Dodd-Frank.
Yes.
Was able to get by the Republicans by asking the Securities and Exchange Commission to set up a fiduciary standard for investment. What did they? No, they don't call it financial advisors.
Right. So the fiduciary standard.
Not investment advisors who already have a fiduciary standard, but financial advisors.
Fiduciary standard, as I said, is someone that's in the practice of working in the best interest of their clients.
Right.
So a doctor in a typical situation would be considered a fiduciary. An attorney working for their client is considered a fiduciary.
Mm-hmm.
A chiropractor is not necessarily considered a fiduciary. In fact, in most cases, not considered a fiduciary. So there's some clear definitions there. A chiropractor may be working in your good interest, but
a chiropractor can basically sell you stuff.
Right. They can sell you things. Where a doctor, for instance, in the state of Texas, a doctor is not allowed to own a pharmacy for the reason that that's a conflict of interest.
Right.
He might just be writing prescriptions for you to go to his pharmacy.
But on the other hand, your financial advisor has, virtually without exception, huge, if the person's a, quote, financial advisor, end quote.
Those two words together.
By definition, they're operating under huge conflicts of interest where they get paid to do things that are not in your best interest. And they may want to do things in your best interest.
But they get paid to do things that are not in their best interest.
They get paid when they sell stuff that they're employer tells them to sell to you, which may or may not be in your best interest. It's not a matter that it may be good for you or bad for you. It's simply in the best interest of their employer, which is what you expect when you go to the hardware store.
There is a standard that's applied to that called suitability. It must be suitable for the client.
You know what interesting thing I heard a lawyer once describe suitability?
Oh, I'd like to hear it.
It's the ability to file a suit.
And that makes sense. Suitability just means that you can't take a 97-year-old lady, an investor, all in one tech stock that is just IPOing. That's not suitable.
Wait a minute. It doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means that if you get caught,
you might get sued. Yeah, or maybe you'll get fined. So suitability is not anywhere near the standard of fiduciary.
The issue is that Congress passed an act, and both parties supported it, that asked the SEC to produce a fiduciary standard. Actually, what it did is it asked them to investigate the cost of producing a fiduciary standard. And if it
for all financial advisors.
For all financial advisors, stockbrokers they used to be called, but now they call themselves financial advisors. And then get back to Congress and tell them when they were going to implement the rules. Well, because the SEC is half one party and half the other party, and the president during this entire period when all this was going on has been a Democrat, the Republicans have, and huge, and I mean absolutely astonishing quantities of money have flowed into Congress in the lobbying era to prevent any form of financial advisor must work in your best interest from getting by anywhere. The fact that there is a law on the books has allowed the department, well, there's a law on the books that requires the Labor Department to do it.
Right, and there's a law on the books that asks the SEC to say, what would it cost to do this? And they haven't even been able to come out with an appropriate cost measurement to say this is what it would cost, because the people that they're going to investigate are coming back and, well, they've come out with some numbers, but those numbers are disputed by the people who would have to pay that cost. They say that it's a much higher cost. So the numbers that have come out, some people say are not accurate. Others say they're absolutely accurate.
Well, it's kind of interesting because the industry predicts that if the fiduciary standard by the Department of Labor goes into effect this year, which I really do think it's going to.
That'd be nice.
The Secretary of Labor has said, hey, we're going, we finished the comment period. We've met all the requirements. We are going to put it out there, and then 60 days later, it's going to take effect, and it'll probably in the spring. The funny thing is, in Great Britain, this system was established. The equivalent of FINRA was gotten, which is the
Financial Industry Regulatory Authority.
It was completely abolished. And they enlarged their equivalent. They set up a separate system and a separate organization that managed all people who render investment or financial advice for fees, for any compensation whatsoever. They put them all on a fully disclosed fee system, and the world didn't come to an end.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, the financial services companies didn't go out of business. There was a slight reduction in the number of people who were offering investment or financial advice, which then bounded back, so there's more now offering it. Now, the funny thing is, this is one of the more amazing things to me, the fee system, the commissions are still there.
They're just disclosed.
It's just
they tell you what you're paying.
They say to you, look, you can either pay me 6% up front, or you can pay me 1% per year going down the road. Your choice. And this is what's amazing, is a goodly number of people are just opting for the I'll pay you up front.
Yeah.
As long as it's out of the money I'm investing.
See, this is something that should be really clear here. The two of us are prejudiced in that we think that everyone should work with a fiduciary. That's because we are fiduciaries. But that aside, I don't see anything wrong with paying commissions up front. I don't see anything wrong with your financial advisor being compensated. What I do see as wrong is that you don't know how much or when they're being compensated or what causes them to be compensated. You know, and when they hand you an encyclopedia and say, please read this before investing.
They don't actually say that.
But sign this right here. Well, it says it in the prospectus.
Right above where you sign, it says, I have read and understood the prospectus.
Right. And if you haven't read and understood the prospectus, and that's difficult to do for anyone, and we do it sometimes, and it's not fun, then you don't know what you're paying. And even if you have read it, you need to set up a spreadsheet on your own on the side to figure out what it is that is being paid actually.
It's not all in the prospectus either.
That's correct.
The SEC has and FINRA have done some recent crackdowns on mutual funds that are not – they take money that is hidden, that's not – disclosed in the prospectus, that theoretically is internal fund expenses purely as distribution charges and so on that they have to pay anyway. And it turns out what they're doing is they're paying them to the broker dealers who pay them to the financial advisors indirectly. In other words, for example, every major broker dealer for whom a financial advisor works or has contracted works has annual conventions. And they are typically at five-star hotels in exotic locations. Many of them occur in the wintertime, and they're at warm places outside the country.
Or in Hawaii.
Yes.
That's in the country.
Right. Or Puerto Rico. Or anyway, they go in the wintertime to a warm place, and they get to take a person of their choice with them. and they spend a week at a five-star resort. Now, I don't know if you've ever spent a week with another person at a true five-star resort.
It's not,
and
it's
high
not,
season, where it's warm, where it's cold in the United States.
It's not cheap.
And it's warm there. And you're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of dollars per person per visit. And this is the funny thing. Having been a broker for many years, I was a broker for 25 years, which now is called financial advisor. We couldn't call ourselves that back then. I can tell you that I had no clue where the money came from to pay for these amazingly pleasant conventions in Kauai and Oahu and
each of these,
Ireland.
Right.
And
each of these conferences has a big exhibit hall. And in the exhibit hall, it is packed from one end to the other with booths from different mutual fund companies. And each of those mutual fund companies have to pay an exorbitant fee to have that booth, which helps to pay for the trip. So you're being paid by a mutual fund company to go on a trip.
Or a limited partnership company.
Or a real estate company, or whatever. But
right.
It's money that is a form of compensation that's not really well disclosed. If
it's not only not well disclosed, I'm going to tell you, the guys who are getting it don't know where it's coming from, so they can't very well tell you.
Right, right. It's not disclosed to anyone very well.
And the end result is that there's a tremendous amount, and there are big awards given, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
But another thing is,
awards given for selling specific things.
This is one of the strangest things to me. At these conferences, a financial advisor or registered representative, and they call themselves financial advisors now, so to say, a financial advisor has to get certain continuing education hours out of the way each year.
Right.
And so at these conferences, they provide the continuing education hours that pretty much fill up enough to get a year's worth of work done, or at least most of it. And the financial advisor who goes there, it's called educational conference because they're required, FINRA, the regulator
right.
says you have to get this much education. Guess who gives the educational presentations?
It's the same thing as the pharmaceuticals coming in to give education to the doctors.
It's the vendors. It's the people who want you to sell their stuff, who want the financial advisor. And so you wind up with the financial advisor who goes home completely sincere and completely convinced that non-traded real estate investment trusts or oil and gas
MLPs.
Yeah, MLPs, which are master limited partnerships, are obviously the best thing in the universe, and the regulator required him to get that education.
So it must be
at a
okay.
conference that was paid for by the people who are selling the master limited partnerships.
Right. So that's a problem, and that even financial advisors that are working really hard to get things right, if they get all of their continuing education through this system, it's biased.
And one of the funny things is FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority.
Yeah.
Ooh, sounds impressive, right?
It is impressive.
Guess who owns it?
The broker-dealers.
The people they're regulating.
Now, it's called a self-regulatory organization.
It is, yes, indeed.
And in some ways, it has sharper teeth than the SEC.
Mm-hmm. And it's,
but in other ways, it has much less damage. You know, if a financial advisor is found to be doing something incorrectly and it damages clients, they're fined. Sometimes they lose their license.
Mm-hmm. And they get hammered pretty thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. If
but you very rarely see the broker dealer who is a member of FINRA and who pays their big bucks. The CEO of FINRA has something approaching a million, maybe it's over $1 million a year now, annual salary.
Right. As a regulator.
And he is employed by and as is the board of directors are all members of the broker dealers. They're all presidents of the broker dealers that the organization is regulating.
Now, as a self-regulatory organization, it's in their best interest to regulate themselves. However, if the money's drying up from overregulation, then they get a little antsy.
Well, whether that's overregulation or not is a question.
Right. And so when on the other side, if you're a fiduciary, that's an investment advisor, not a financial advisor, and you do the same thing. you somehow damage clients, knowingly damage clients.
Well, it doesn't make any difference whether you knew it or not. Well, it was wrong.
It was wrong. If you did something...
No, it's known or should have known.
Right. The minimum is you might lose your license. There's a high probability of going to prison, mm-hmm. which is a different order of magnitude here.
So why did we get started on that today?
Good reason, because this week has been a bumpy week.
And the reason is we are now officially in a correction. And one of the things that Philip Corre said in the 1930s.
He founded the Pioneer Funds.
You never know who's not wearing a swimming suit until the tide goes out. And
that's just a funny image. I love that.
It might be good to figure out whether you're wearing a swimming suit or not.
Before the tide goes out.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Well, yeah.
And we do have a call on 773-1400. By the way, that's one of the numbers that you can call in here.
The other number is 1-866-597-1400.
So, caller, you're on the air with a personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. There was an article on the Wall Street Journal today.
Lots of them.
Apparently, back in 2010, Bernanke thought that one of the Fed bankers had leaked the results of one of the meeting results.
Right, I remember that.
I don't know if that's true or not, but what kind of are they legally bound to keep their mouth shut, or what's going to happen if that's found out to be true? I'll hang up on this.
Okay.
Yes, they're legally bound to keep their mouth shut. That's a simple answer. The complex answer. The Federal Reserve Board has some tools in its belt. One of the tools is to buy and sell bonds on the open market. Bernanke was the first chairman of the Federal Reserve to make the meeting notes, the minutes of their meetings, public. It happens 3 weeks after the meeting, but he's the first one that's opened up the doors and said, this is what's going on. So the open market committee, they're the people that buy and sell bonds on the open market. This is the only group of people in the world that are allowed to know on the open market who they are buying bonds from. Usually, if you go to the market and you sell a bond or buy a bond, you don't know who you're buying it from. You might know if you're buying it from the broker-dealer. Either the broker-dealer holds it and they say, oh, we have some in our own assets, here you go. And they have to disclose that, because if they're selling you their own assets, they have to say, okay, we have a conflict of interest. It's not easily disclosed. It's not easy to understand, but they can tell you. Most of the time, though, if you go to buy or sell a bond, you don't know who the person is on the other side of the transaction. That's not true with the Federal Reserve. When the Federal Reserve was doing its quantitative easing number two and number three, it was buying bonds on the open market. And if it's kind of like Walt Disney, when he went to Florida to buy up the land for Disney World, he had a bunch of shell companies go in there and buy up the land, because if everybody knew that Walt Disney was buying the land, then the prices would go up through the stratosphere. If everybody knew, if the Federal Reserve was the one buying their bond, they may change the negotiation practice. Or if they knew that the Federal Reserve was buying a lot more bonds this week than it did last week, it might cause the market to crash or go up. So it's called insider information. If you work as an executive at Microsoft and you send an email after a board meeting to your friend and say you should buy Microsoft right now, that's illegal. There are some forms of speech that are protected, and there's other forms of speech that are damaging to other people. And the reason is that in order to make money on that tip, you make the money from somebody that didn't know it. So when the Federal Reserve leaks information, it's on a larger scale. It causes instability on a much larger scale, and yes, it's illegal.
The fact that it's out in the notes now and no direct action was taken in 2010 is a powerful indicator that an investigation went on, because the mere fact that it's in the news and the chairman said it means that the Inspector General of the Federal Reserve did investigate it.
Mm-hmm.
He probably, the Federal Reserve, and I don't know, because you don't see the end result because they don't publish those, but the end result, I'm quite confident, was that no, the member of the Federal Reserve did not leak the information.
Or if he did, he leaked information that wasn't vital in some way.
Or maybe it was an inadvertent slip of the tongue or something, but a reading of body language. Let me simply say that the fact that it's in the notes
and no prosecution's underway,
and they published the notes, means that no court order came along, by the way, and told them. By the way, when we say the notes are public, the detailed notes, they publish a summary after the meeting now. But the detailed notes of the meeting are not published for several years, which is why we're only seeing them come out now from 2010. And like I said, the fact that the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the meeting formally suggested that a member had leaked information meant there was a thorough investigation, and they concluded that it didn't happen. Because had it happened, it would have been headline news, I'll assure you.
Yeah, not, and it could be that they're still waiting to release it, but it's they typically won't wait 5 years or 6 years to do
and,
that.
And I don't think you're going to see anything more from it. It's one of those things. That's one of the reasons that they're kept secret for so long, is the Federal Reserve meets. They are free to talk about whatever they want to talk about. They have to vote on the summary. They have to approve the summary that's going to be released before it's released, which comes out, 3 months later?
3 weeks later.
3 weeks later. The members of the Fed all look at it and say, yeah, that's okay.
Minutes are correct, yeah.
But what they don't say in there, what's not in that thing that comes out 3 weeks later, is if there is some, I have a concern that this might be happening discussion.
Right.
And somebody, we don't know. If it's a legitimate concern that this might be happening in the economy, that's one thing. The data is all there. It's just that this might mean this or it might mean that. If there is something that comes out in the regular meeting, the members of the Federal Reserve are free to discuss it openly. And the fact that later on it may be proved to be completely incorrect, the fact that's a good reason that it should not be released publicly.
One of the fundamental aspects of what the Federal Reserve is supposed to be doing, Congress laid on a set of responsibilities with the Dodd-Frank Act. And one of that, it's a very difficult responsibility, which is to help control the volatility of the marketplace. So somehow lessen panic events and also dampen down the greed events. If information is leaked to the public that might be contrary to the fundamental aspect of what they're supposed to do, I mean, there's a law that says this is their job, and they do something that's contrary to that law. Well, when you do something contrary to the law, it's called breaking the law. This is why they investigated it. So watching the stability of the market is the hardest job that they have, as we've seen this week. It's a nice little transition. This week, looking at the fundamentals of the United States economy, it's really, if that were all we were able to see, and we watched the market do what it did, we're both bald, so you can tell when we're confused by the scratch marks on our head. If we lived in a microcosm that was just the United States, it wouldn't make any sense at all for the market to drop the way it did. It still doesn't make a lot of sense when you throw in the rest of the world.
Well, there's
a panic that happened.
One of the things that happened, and I think this is, and there's a little humor here.
More than a little.
It's dark humor, but there's humor.
Unless you made money, and then it's not dark humor.
Bank stocks, the market is down over 10%.
Right.
The S&P 500, and it's down actually 12.98% from its high in May. And I've seen numbers that run all over the place on that. But that's as of the close Friday. In the newsletter I published last night, email that went out. I actually cite the numbers, and then I did the math between the two numbers on the day's close at the high and then at Friday, and it's 12.98%, which looks like 13 to me. Anyway, So we're in a correction, but bank stocks are down over 20% as a group.
Yeah, yesterday, just yesterday, Citigroup was down 6.4%.
And that's
just in a day.
Was it Citigroup or Citibank yesterday?
Citibank. That's Citigroup is the same. Yeah.
Reported earnings. Now get this. Earnings in the fourth quarter for this stock that went down so much yesterday are 400% of that was predicted.
Right.
So and
earnings
so stock
massive
dropped.
Up. Stock drops more close to 6.5% in a single day.
Now, this is the point. Bank stocks are in a bear market. They're down more than 20%.
Yes.
Now, this is why. Because, in this, I love this humor. The underlying thought is that because of the down market, the Federal Reserve is unlikely to raise interest rates quickly. So bank stocks went down.
There's no rationale here. We just got to stop a second.
Do you remember when it looks like the Federal Reserve might raise interest rates
and
to 0.25%
crash.
And the bank stocks went down.
Right. This is something that that people out there really have to understand.
They do?
Well, if they want to live a sane existence while investing.
Probably just ignore the market. Right.
When events like what's happened this week happen, it's impossible to give a reason why it happened. But there is a race among the loudest people out there to say, this is why, and to sound like they have the answers, when the reality is that a lot of people got scared.
I have the answer.
You have the answer? Go ahead.
Investor sentiment turned negative.
Right. That's it. I mean, people sold more than they bought, and they did it in droves because they were afraid.
Now, droves is very good because that is a term that it implies cattle.
Yes, droving. You've got to go against the herd if you're going to make money in the market. And this is a prime example of that, where the lemmings all ran off the cliff.
And there's a lot of lemmings that ran off the cliff on Friday.
Yes, a lot of them. And the idea that now somehow is a good time to sell, because we're hearing that. We're hearing people saying, should I get out of the market? You did a great job in the newsletter this week, by the way, in giving a good perspective on corrections and bear markets, because they happen. Not only do they happen, they're going to happen again. The corrections and bear markets are the way that we get the amateurs out of the market regularly. It's painful for them. Because they try to get out of the market at the wrong time, and they try to get into the market at the wrong time. They shouldn't be in the market at all. If we look over at what's going on in China, there's a lot of reports going on there. China, mm-hmm. The stock market of China is run by absolute amateurs. I mean, by the vast majority of people investing in the market are absolute amateurs.
And the regulators are very, very powerful amateurs.
Right. So, and by amateurs, this is what I mean. There are people that used to watch cooking channels. There's groups of ladies that get together, and they are grandmothers usually. And they are the majority of the investment in the Chinese stock market.
Really?
Yeah, and there's a lot of news coming out about this right now. They're not trying to long-term invest. There are massively popular mainstream television programs that come on all during the day telling you how to make money in the stock market. And these older ladies that have never invested in their life until the last couple of years are all sitting around trying to figure out how to buy and sell stocks to make the most money possible. And let me take a step back here and say that's not the purpose of the stock market. I know a lot of people in the United States that are day traders, and they're just trying to make the most money as possible out of the stock market on any given day. That's not what it's for. The stock market is a way to own companies so that you can make money off of the earnings of the company, or that you can, if it's a well-managed company, you can sell it later with a larger result, or possibly you just want to own and run a company if you're talking about Warren Buffett. And they want to make money off of the value that's being produced by that company. When we see an event like we saw on Friday, what we have is a lot of people that don't know why they're in the market. If you don't know why you're in the market, if you think you're in the market because it only goes up, you shouldn't be in the market. And if you don't know why you're in the market, then when the market goes down, it's likely you're going to leave and lose a lot of money.
Well, we're going to talk about more of Mr. Market's behavior after we come back from commercials, but we do need to do that. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and if today is Saturday, January 16th, 2016, you're certainly welcome on the other side of commercials to give us a call at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
We'll be back.
I'm Nick Soboleski.
Back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And it's, if you're listening live and in living color, it's 10:50, 10 minutes until 11 on this Saturday, January 16th, 2016. So this is 1-16-16. We won't ever get to 16-16-16, though, so we should kind of enjoy the 1-16-16 when we got it, as long as we have it. All right? That's good. Of course, 10-16-16 will also be nice numbers. Anyway, talking about Mr. Market, we, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show today, or it's not a show, it's a program, although I don't think we're programmed. Anyway, the market is in a classic definition of a correction right now, down about 13% from its all-time high that it hit last May. Funnily or strangely, I see lots of other numbers out there, like the market high on June 23rd. I don't know what market was high on June 23rd. But
yeah, they're just grabbing numbers.
Yeah, and some aspects of the market are already in a bear, which is down 20%. I think, this is Jeff speaking, this is just my personal opinion, and it's sometimes really good and sometimes not so good. I think we're probably closer to the bottom than we are to the top at this point, which means that we may get down and flirt with the 20% level. That's entirely possible. But one of the things I mentioned in the newsletter I just published, and I really am quite confident about at this point, the signs of a major bear market, the kind that devastates economies and portfolios, the kind that we had in 2000, that began in late 2007, began in late 2000, the kind that began in 1973 and in 1929, this is not one of them. Why do I say that? A lot of reasons.
Lots of reasons.
For starters, it's probably the single biggest thing is the Wile E. Coyote factor is not in the market. And the Wile E. Coyote factor, that I termed that, by the way. I don't know anyone else that's ever used that. If you've ever seen a Roadrunner cartoon with Wile E. Coyote, he has a tendency to be running along on top of a mesa and keep running when the mesa isn't there anymore and finally notices that he isn't running on solid ground after he's run quite a little distance off into space. That's what happens at the beginning of big-time financial collapses. The underlying economy goes south in a large fashion, and the market ignores it and continues to rise. I mentioned in the newsletter in 2000, prime example, the price-to-earnings ratio of the stock exchange, the current price-to-earnings ratio, ran up to about 30 before the market started to fall. That means it would take, on the average, 30 times annual earnings to pay for a share of stock. That is absurd. That's one of those things where stocks are worth pretty much what they earn in the end. Some stocks get way above that because people expect them to earn more in the future. Earnings are profits. Companies are valued on their profits or, as in the case of value stocks, on the underlying value of their assets. But when the market as a whole gets that far ahead of itself, I don't think anybody's willing to wait around for 30 years. And that assumes that earnings will grow forever, which is a really, really, really bad idea. Now, let me give you an example. You might think that, like, Apple is an overpriced stock. It's not.
We're not recommending buying Apple or Citigroup or any of the others that we're talking about.
I don't recommend you purchase any individual stock. It's That's pure speculation. That's, you might as well go to Vegas. Your odds are probably better. But the point is, it is a low price to earnings ratio stock, relatively speaking. Because if you look at its earnings and you look at the price of the stock, even though the dollar number is really high, it's pretty low compared to the rest of the market.
Price to earnings ratio for Apple is 9.55 right now.
It's 9, where I don't know. I haven't looked up the current price to earnings ratio of the market. I did read in the Wall Street Journal yesterday it was 15.9.
It's 19 point something,
trailing,
I think.
Trailing, yeah.
Trailing. The last 12 months trailing price
versus
earnings.
The if we last look, quarter, which is whatever.
15. And if we like to look at the forward leaning price to earnings ratio, which is much lower. It's getting down to the 12 point now.
Okay, so. Based on that, the stock market is either slightly underpriced or reasonably priced. Morningstar just came out and said that the S&P 500, if you take all the stocks in the S&P 500, they are at about 80% of what Morningstar considers fair market value of those stocks.
Right.
This is not the way you start a major bear market.
No, you start a major bear market when everything is really overvalued.
Yeah.
When you look at what they're earning, and it would take you 130 years to get from the earnings the price of the stock back. And there's some companies out there that are like that. I think Twitter has a P.E. ratio that's unmentionable because it doesn't have any earnings.
There are always a few stocks like that. Now, again, you look at bank stocks. And for better or worse, a big chunk of the stock market is financials. And they are down in the single digits as far as price to earnings ratios. Those are cheap. Now, does that mean that you should buy them now and they will for sure go up? No. There's a lot of value showing up in the stock market, and we're just barely into a correction. This would be a strong indication that this is not a major bear market. Another strong indication. The yield curve, this far into a bear market, which is, if it started in May, we're well into it.
By the way, the yield curve is not the curve with the yield sign on it that
you
take at high speed. That's a road. The yield curve is when you look at interest on short-term money, it's usually a lot less than interest on long-term money. If you want to take a loan for 30 days, they're going to charge you a very small amount of money. But if you want to take a loan for 30 years, they're going to charge you a higher interest rate.
And this is the way Treasury securities and other securities work. And right now, there's a 2% differential, which in terms of a percentage of the whole is huge, between short-term money and long-term money. In other words, short-term money is still paying next to nothing.
And long-term money is paying about 2% more than that next to nothing.
And as a result, that's a big spread. A positive yield curve this far into a, and that's called a positive yield curve, this far into a supposed bear market that started last May, because historically we'll look back and say this downturn started in May and there was a big sell-off in January.
Yes. In May, we wouldn't have said that. We would have said, it's a little bumpy all of a sudden. But now we can look back with the advent of history and say, yes, that's when the market started down.
And this is so this deep, this long into a market decline, in every major bear market, without exception, the yield curve had gone inverted. And it's not inverted. It's still quite positive. Is that a guarantee that we're going to have an instant market recovery? No.
That's even with the Federal Reserve raising short-term rates. What that means, that has a tendency to make the yield curve kind of go upside down because the short-term rates go up. And if the long-term rates don't go up at the same time, you got a bad yield curve.
And we actually did see long-term rates come down this last week, but we're still not in a negative. We're not in an inverted yield curve. So the symptoms, it's like if you go to the doctor and you say, I think I have the flu and pneumonia and I'm going to die. And they look at your everything and they say, no, what I think you have is a cold. Odds are you have a cold.
Yeah.
And you don't have, and if you've ever had a cold, and some people don't get them, I can't believe that. So, but if you've ever had a cold, you recognize that there are a couple of days in there when you think you're going to die and you feel like you've got the flu and pneumonia and you're going to die.
I got a better example.
What's that?
The percentage of the U.S. economy that's made up of oil and gas, petroleum stuff, is if you look at the percentages of a human body, we're about out of time. It's like your pinky toe. We just stubbed the pinky toe really, really badly. Even though that pinky toe is going to make it a lot easier to run further and faster now, that pinky toe is all we're thinking about. And it's really easy to think you're about to die when you stub your pinky toe. And that's what we've done. We're about out of time. Yes.
I mean, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have a local telephone number with voicemail on the weekends, real people during the week, 947-1111 or
1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can email us, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth
Coach. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.